Hi everyone, this is Randy. Lily's not here for the intro today, so I get to tell a quick story before we get to our amazing guest this week. And then stay tuned for that, because this was a great chat. So, 5 years ago, Lily and I started this podcast, but originally I was gonna do it by myself. I'd had the idea to talk to people who did amazing product tank talks from all over the world. And, you know, my first career had been as a music journalist and I'd worked in radio, so I thought it would be easy. So I bought a mic and I started doing practice introductions. And, they were just awful. I played one for my wife and she laughed at it. Or maybe she laughed at me. Either way, it was not good. And the reason it was awful is that I went straight into a cheesy American DJ voice, and no, I will not be doing that for you again right now. So I called Lily and asked her if she'd do the podcast with me. You know, she's just as much of a product management geek as I am. She's all kinds of sharp, and she just seemed like the kind of person I wanted to talk to all the time. And this podcast would just not exist today without her. So when she's not here, I get to embarrass her and say thanks again. Everything we are today is because she said yes and agreed to do this with me. But enough of that for today. For this episode, we had a great chat with Omer Kaplan. He's the head of product at Sonar Health. He talked to us about what it's like to work on a product that's got the mission to help both people with an opiate dependency and those who treat them. And, you know, not just to work on this, but to approach the mission from a perspective of equity-first product design. I talked to lots of people who get to a point in their career where they want to work on things that matter, you know, things that do good. Chatting with Omer is a total inspiration on that front. So let's just get straight to our conversation. And thanks again for listening. The Product Experience is brought to you by Mind the Product. Every week on the podcast, we talk to the best product people from around the globe.
Visit mindtheproduct.com to catch up on past episodes and discover loads of free resources to help you with your product practice. You can also find more information about Mind the Product's conferences and their great training opportunities happening around the world and online.
Create a free account on the website for a fully personalized experience and to get access to the full library of awesome content and the weekly curated newsletter. Mind the Product also offers free Product Tank meetups in more than 200 cities. There's probably one near you. Omer, thank you so much for joining us this week. How are you doing?
Great. Thank you for having me. I'm super excited to be here. How are you? How's life?
Yeah, everything's good. We're excited about this chat. I'm excited because I've already had a chat with you about some of this stuff, but I want to share it with everyone else. So I know who you are. Can you do a quick introduction? What are you doing these days and how did you get into the world of product in the first place?
That's a great question to start with. So my name is Omer Kaplan. I've been in product management for about 17 years, which will tell you something about my age. I am currently the head of product at a company called Sonar Health, which I'm sure we'll talk plenty about. It's a healthcare technology company focused on people with opioid dependency. Previous to that, I've been a product director at one of the largest health systems in the US. Prior to that, plenty of direct-to-consumer. I had a pretty diverse career. I'm sure we'll touch base on all that.
So this is why we really wanted to talk to you. This is, you know, I talk to lots of people who get to certain points in their career and say, I want to do something that gives back. I want to do something that is product for good. But product for people with opioid dependencies, it doesn't get much better than that in terms of things. How did you get into this space in the first place?
So I was working. So as I mentioned, I worked as a product director at a big health system. And I witnessed firsthand how hard it is to facilitate change, even as a product organization in a executive management position with all the resources and the team and everything you want. It's really hard to facilitate change from within the system. So because the main objective of a health system, in my case, pediatric health system, is take care of sick kids and their parents. And it's great and it's doing for good and it's very community oriented. But then I kind of felt like, and I've done startups my entire career, so I eventually surmised that in order to really solve really hard problems that health systems don't have the resources or the mindset to do, the best thing to do is go back into startups, get external funding from venture capital or what else, and then solve the really, really hard problems from the outside to make an impact. And that's the main reason I said, okay, well, what's the hardest problem we can solve today in the US? And I had a couple of options. One of them was, you know, a bunch of people, really young startup company that says, we're going to end the opioid crisis. We're going to make a dent there. And I was like, okay, that sounds super hard. So here I am.
And you're dealing with this incredibly challenging space. And we're going to spend the conversation digging into some of the challenges and how you deal with it. But let's set the scene. What is Sonora's mission? What is it that you guys are setting out to do?
So our mission at Sonora Health is equitably increase access to life-saving medications. So that's a really high vision. More focused is we are helping people with opioid dependency, one, get into treatment, and then also once they're into treatment, help them stay in treatment longer, support them, support their care teams. Because the landscape for opioid dependency today is really complex from a lot of sides, both from a patient standpoint, their care teams, regulations. It's putting a lot of barriers in front of people who are, all they want to do is get into treatment. They start helping themselves. So from a data standpoint, for example, 90% of people who need opioid debt or want to get opioid treatment for their opioid dependency are not in treatment. And this is where we are. So we're sitting on the junction of regulations, care teams, and most importantly, people who want to get better.
And one of the things that I kind of learned early on in my career was, you know, if it doesn't go live, if you don't ship it, it's not a problem. No one's gonna, you know, no one's gonna be massively impacted by this. But you're working on one of those products where, you know, you are literally changing lives and saving lives with the, you know, technology solution. So tell us about kind of how you approach that, how you approach your user research, how you kind of get to know your users, and how you work in that environment where the stakes are really high.
Yeah, so that's a great question. So first of all, what's special about what we do at Sonora Health is that even as a product person, because I'm not a clinician, we have clinicians on our team, but as a person who is not a clinician, the distance between what I'm doing and the actual impact on people's lives is very small. So I can, as a product person, draw the lines and say, because of what I did from a product standpoint and business standpoint, we are helping people. So a person wakes up in the morning, use our product, and then they have more time to spend with their family, more time to spend on employment, more time to have relationships. And like, we get immediate feedback. So that's great. So the part about user research is, so user research in our company is very special compared to other places I worked at for a couple of reasons. So from a patient standpoint, we talk to patients or, you know, the population we work with. Because of all the regulations and barriers and all the things I mentioned previously, those people are living their treatment lives believing that the system is against them, right? So we talk to a person, and the first thing we have to establish, even before we hear their story and gather information and listen in general, is establishing a baseline of, you know, this thing won't have a negative impact on your life. Like, we are, like, they don't really care about that we are, you know, a startup company in the healthcare setting. You know, all they think about, is this conversation to my best benefit? And this is a regular product interview. So from a patient standpoint, it's a lot of empathy, a lot of listening in order to get to the story. So the interviews where we listen the most is the interviews that we get the most value from. Otherwise, we're getting really, you know, defensive answers or really answers that are meant to make us feel good, because patients, we have a really good patient satisfaction scores. So people love our product. And sometimes when people love the product so much, they don't want to get off the program. When we interview them, they'll give you stuff like, oh, this is great. I wouldn't change anything. Like, my story is all positive, which is not helpful for us. So it's building a level of empathy and connectiveness that is making a difference. I would add that from a clinicians and care team standpoint, we're dealing with more of the systematic approach. So historically, now we won't have time. Maybe one time we'll do a special episode on the history of opioid treatment in the US. But just to touch a little bit of history, the whole notion of opioid treatment programs in the US is starting from peer support. It starts from a lot of regulations, underfunding. So clinicians that we talk to are mostly undertrained, underpaid, overworked, lots of turnover. And the last thing they need right now is another healthcare technology company who's like, you know, super motivated to make a dent in this really environment. It's really hard to change. So I think specifically with care teams, it's also a lot of empathy and a lot of listening, but it's also the acknowledgement of, you know, we know like what are the pain points in your profession, and we're not here to fix it. We're here to support whatever you're struggling with. And there also we're getting the best stories.
So you talked about, you know, discovery in this case is a lot of it is about establishing trust. That's something that's really applicable to other people, but you're doing it at a more extreme level. What's some of the techniques that you use when walking into to establish that trust?
Not very much different from us talking about it in a podcast. So, you know, you meet a person. I think the first thing we're trying to establish is that there is no interviewer-interviewee relationship. It's not a user researcher and a person. We're two people or one person coming in to listen to a story and navigate that story using guiding questions, kind of like what we're doing here. Not from a place of representing the system, not from a place of, oh, you tell me how to improve my product, because that's not really valuable to us. We're there to listen to a patient's story, learn about their day-to-day, learn about, you know, how was their day yesterday and what did they do? And from that story, through the guiding questions, we really get the details that we want. So we have some sort of a framework. But that's the way we establish trust. We also get into a habit of compensating for our interviews. So the person feels that they're being valued for their time, even though it's a more casual conversation. And I think that's pretty much it.
Yeah, that's great. Good. Compensation for people's time is something that doesn't come up quite as often as it should do. I'm not going to ask you the exact amounts you pay, but just in terms of guidance, what kind of range do you see that's generally considered fair?
Oh, I can tell you exactly how much we pay. So if you were to come into an interview, we would pay $45. We usually do it in gift cards. And we actually run, so we treat our, maybe that's a cool point to talk about. We treat our discovery process as a product in and of itself. So we run iterations and testing, and we try different avenues and different hypotheses to test. So we did experiment with price and of the like compensation for the interview. And we found that, you know, sometimes higher compensation doesn't necessarily lead to more schedules, more show rate. Same thing about maybe a lower end of compensation. It's kind of like a combination of the medium that you reach out towards, the option that you provide, how you do position the interview, and then the compensation always helps.
And I'm curious to know if you have to make any other adjustments. You talked about regulation earlier. So in terms of like how you perform the interviews, and also like how you schedule discovery interviews as well. Like I've always found it really interesting how different businesses approach that.
So we tried a whole bunch of different methodologies. So we tried scheduling interviews through the product. We tried reaching out directly. We tried phone calls. We tried to schedule interviews with patients through their providers. What have worked best for us is the personal approach. So we would reach out directly via email and say, hey, you know, we tested a lot of like ways to invite people to interviews. And we found that the most effective way is the invitation type. So because an invitation, when you get an invitation, you can approve, you can decline, the stakes are really low, right? When a friend like say, hey, I'm inviting you to a party, you can say yes, no, like there's no high stakes there. So we're writing like an email invitation and say, hey, we'd like to know, like hear more about your life, your life story, your experience. And here are some options for time slots. So what we do is we embed the time slots for the interview in the email itself. So all the person has to do is say, oh, okay, well, you know, he doesn't have to reply back and say, oh, I'm interested. And then, oh, when it's like when it's convenient to schedule, doing all that dance. We just embed the time in the email. They click, they schedule. And then when they schedule, we have an automated workflow that sends them reminders one day before. And we're getting a pretty good show rate. Like, it's not perfect. We're still working on it, but we're getting consistently at least one interview per week on topics that we choose. So we're getting this consistent flow of information.
Omer, you talked earlier about Sonora's mission being equity first. And I'm curious, we've talked about equity first product design with you earlier. What exactly do you mean by that?
So to me, so it means different things to a lot of people. And the definition we kind of arrived after talking about internally is equity first design is everything we just talked about in this podcast. It's taking the stigma and the bias and special parameters of our patients and put them all in context of our product. And when I say our product, I mean the entire process. So our product isn't only our digital aspects or applications or things people do on their phones. It's also everything from when patients get to the clinic and get onboarded to the product and interact with our printed materials and being activated on the platform by the clinicians. It's the entire service that we offer. And all that stuff needs to be with equity in mind. So for example, all our printed materials, all our prompts in the app, and all our illustrations, we run them through what we call Lexi level, which is the level that people in the US use to evaluate reading level with kids. So all our prompts and materials and everything is second grade or third grade level reading material, because we have a lot of patients that have low literacy, low digital literacy. So everything is really adjusted with the patient population in mind, and also considering like the external factors. So we use terminology like opioid dependency and not addiction, because addiction is a very charged word and comes with a lot of like bias. So, and we want patients to know that this is what we mean. And we hear their story and we're going through the journey with them. It's also a lot of our patients, for example, have government issued phones. So all our development, all our testing, the language that we talk is through the context of the devices that our patients use. But I'm looking at it more holistically. So the entire service that we offer goes beyond our, you know, what people traditionally define as product.
And when you're designing for a product in that way, like, how does that change your sort of testing regime? How do you ensure that any, you know, you mentioned that you check copy, but there must be other things that you have in place to ensure that as you're introducing new features or making changes, that it's really sort of like working for everyone across the board?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when we design, we have a library of design components that is really accessible. So for example, basic stuff like large buttons, the difference between the colors that we use and the background. And once we have a component or some design that we're thinking that may work with our patients, we run usability testing with patients. We have a way to, kind of similarly to how we schedule interviews, we have a way to socialize prototypes with our patients. We also have customer success representatives that are in the physical centers we work with multiple times a month. So we would take the prototypes to the patients, to clinicians, and validate our assumptions and hypotheses before testing them like in the product itself.
That's what you deal with for the patients. What about for the clinicians? That's got to be their own special challenge.
Yes. So clinicians are a great bunch. And they're using, in other parts of the world, they use EMRs. So the software installed of their computers to document and chart and do all the billing and stuff. And those softwares, we love them a lot. They weren't this.
Sorry, EMR, it's electronic medical records?
Yes.
Hey, yeah. I guessed you're right.
Nice, you got it. Yeah, I was simplifying for the sake of people who are not like in the jargon. But yes, so EMRs do all the charting, billing, orders, referrals, whatnot. And those type of software is usually designed with, let's say, efficiency in mind and not necessarily the user in mind. But from our standpoint, there needs to be a connective thread between how accessible and usable our interfaces to the familiarity of EMRs. So we don't want to create a big discrepancy where, you know, our system is modern and efficient and uses all these really cool tricks and shortcuts, and then they go to the EMR and it's like a completely disconnected experience. We want to create something that has continuity. So, and that's why we invest a lot of resources to talk to clinicians and learn about their workflows and how they work and how they search and how they chart, to create this flow where a clinician would have Sonara embedded into their workflow. And there's not a big difference between how they work in the EMR when they spend most of the day to Sonara when they have this really short instances of experience with. So it's all kind of feel unified in that sense.
So we've talked a lot about how you specifically approach user research and discovery and building features for Sonara for your users. And with your mission kind of being to get people who are dependent on opioids into treatment. Have you got an example that you can walk us through? Because it's always so great to hear the details of case studies and stuff. Have you got an example of some research that you did and insight that you found and then a feature that you developed and how you measured the success of that you can talk us through as a bit of a case study?
Okay, yes, I have an example for you, and I'm going to have the audio people use their imagination while I show something to the people in the video. And we go a little bit into how Sonara works in two sentences. So for patients, they have to take a video of themselves every day while they take their medication. And after they send a video of themselves taking the medication, their clinicians and care team review the videos and make sure they're taking the medication on time, according to all the guidances, and they're not diverting their daily medication, which is, by the way, an opioid in and of itself. So that's why the whole regulation around it. So on Sonara, every bottle of medication have a label on it. So we have this green label that goes on the bottles. Every label have a QR code where patients scan the code and then it validates the bottle and everything else. So the goal of the QR code is for their clinicians to see that the bottle wasn't tampered with for the most part. And then this is how we ship the product. This was very early on. And what we found out through our user interviews and research and the data that we got from launching the product is that the whole process of scanning the code, which again, the goal was for a clinician to validate the bottle, is causing a lot of anxiety with patients because their take-home medication schedule was dependent on them being successful in the program. And we found that they're dedicating a lot of time and effort and mental capacity in making sure that the code is scanned. And, you know, with government issued phones, your mileage may vary. And it's hard. We heard patients says, wow, you know, this program is really good for me, but I don't want to lose my take home medication. So I want to do better. I want to scan those codes and it doesn't scan. And for some people, it happened consistently. And in order to build trust between patients and providers, we had to do the exact opposite. So we wanted to build trust and reduce mental burden and anxiety. So we developed a flow where if they aren't able to scan the QR codes in a very short amount of time, because if it works, it works. And if not, we don't want the patient to feel too anxious. Then we say, okay, that's fine. And we did a lot of experiment around that transition. And we say to the patient, we're saying in the app, let's verify another way. Take the bottle, show it to the camera on all sides. Make sure that, you know, you show the bottle all the way through. And then you can continue with the process the way it used to be. And we did a lot of experiment around that transition because also we didn't want the patient to feel that they failed. So we had them scan the bottles and then tested a lot of terminology and visual reinforcement to say, hey, this is fine. Just show the bottle from all sides and you can continue. And that reduced the amount of anxiety and the time spent on scanning the codes dramatically. And now it's kind of like ubiquitous. Now like nobody's paying attention to it, but it used to be a big deal. And clinicians are happy, patients are happy. And it was one of our early great accomplishments.
And it's interesting, Omar, when, you know, if your measure is reducing anxiety, in the process, how did you track to see, you know, how kind of anxious people were feeling in that part of the process?
So that's a great question. So the first signal we got came from the data. We saw people trying to scan the codes multiple times, spend a lot of, not only the amount of attempts to scan the code, but also the amount of time that they're spending scanning the code as opposed to the entire session. So the recording itself is guided and it went fine, but then the patient spent like 50% of the time trying to scan. So, you know, I'm looking at the data and I'm saying, wow, I'm trying to imagine what's an average session look like. And I'm imagining a patient trying to scan and it doesn't work and they really want to get to the recording, but they can't, and they're trying and finally something happened and they can't do it. But it's a huge dissatisfier. And then I said, okay, well, I have the signal from the data. I wonder how big of a deal that is. And then that's a lot of the, you know, the product management continuous quest for understanding is like, I had to know. So I was going to the other place that have data on it, which is our support tickets. And I was looking at the support tickets and like 80, okay, I'm hyperballing. 50% of the requests are, it doesn't scan. I'm trying to scan. So I say, okay, I have two sources. Let's go to talk to patients that have issues scanning and like learn what's the big deal. And overwhelmingly, all those patients say, like, I'm trying to scan, I'm trying to do good, I'm trying to, like, this program is so helpful for me. I need to be successful and scan the code consistently. And we know that from a clinician standpoint, the meaning is I need to see the bottle, make sure it wasn't tampered with. But from the patient, such a big deal to be successful that we felt that like our working hypothesis was we can bridge that gap. We can build something that can make the patients feel successful, make their sessions shorter and more efficient, and the clinicians aren't losing any of the benefits. So we get both.
I think that's such a great story. And it, you know, we always talk about how product people need to be curious, but, you know, we need to be really good investigators as well. And like, yes, you know, not be satisfied with the first piece of data that we see and like really dig into stuff. So it's, yeah, really interesting to hear that story. Thank you.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. And I think for product people, the trick is, because we always want to know and also want to understand, it's a matter of, and I'm experiencing it like as the product grows, is what's the best use of our investigative time? So what, you know, what type of situation require, like, going to have the most impact that's going to justify the digging into data and going all the way through to create this hypothesis?
Omer, I want to switch gears a tiny bit. But so a moment ago, we were talking about anxiety, but I want to talk about anxiety from a different perspective. You moved from senior product roles to, at Sonara, it's a small company, but you're part of the leadership team now. What was the biggest challenge or learning that you had moving into that type of role?
Right. So I think throughout my entire career, one of the guidelines I made for myself, and maybe it was counterproductive to maybe how other people see their career pathway, is that I didn't want to get to a more senior title before I walked the path of the previous one. So I really got to experience all the different tiers, let's call it, in product management. So I was a product management, and then senior, and then a team lead, and then a director, and now I'm a head of product. And I think I didn't jump then to next level before I got a good amount of time and understanding of the role. I think we can go even farther than that, but as a product director, for example, I was looking at my own product line or multiple product lines even, and then working on the roadmap and the backlog and product vision and, you know, talking to that company's executives to communicate the vision and going from there. I think the biggest switch between like a director role and the head of product is that now I'm part of the C-suite, and I'm not only doing all the product stuff and the vision and the backlog and everything, I'm also part of a really small group that's running a business. And that understanding of what does it take to run a business, it was very new to me. You know, I'm finding myself reading a P&L report, which is for our finance people. It's a profit and loss, very nice document that showcases the cash flow of the company. So I'm reading, like finding myself reading a P&L document and saying, okay, from a product standpoint, what does that mean? And how does the company's financial impact the distribution of resources? What does it mean for from the product? What initiatives should be focusing on? How does everything we do connect to the business goals of the organization? I had that in the director level as well. But now everything, as a head of product, everything gets real. Because I know that especially for a startup company, we don't have a lot of wiggle room and every decision we make is critical. And I know that because I'm looking at the P&L report, like I'm seeing the actual bank account. And I think that was the major challenge is, you know, as a director, I knew how the money flows and I knew how to connect everything we do to business goals. It's different from running a business. The nice part about being a head of product, other than all the other stuff that's nice, is that I get a bigger say in building the culture of the company. So, you know, as a director, you kind of like inherit a lot of things from the organization. As a C-suite, you get to create, lead towards the culture that you want, which is kind of like the another great benefit.
I was going to ask, you know, in all of the different roles that you've held in product, like which was your favorite, but I feel like I know what the answer is going to be now.
Okay, so tell me what you think and I'll tell you if it's true.
I would have said product director or in the leadership.
I'm guessing he once you got the taste of leadership, you're really happy with that.
No, I think that, so the real answer, and I'm sorry that I'm like such a product person. So product person would say it depends. But what I'll say is that I actually liked all of them. There's, you know, even as a PM at a company, getting like having a full day of deep diving into one feature and working with designers and engineers and like obsessing about user experience and like on a very, very narrow niche. There's like, if I had the bandwidth, I'll do that all day and also all the other stuff. Leadership is great. It's very different, but it's all kind of like evolutionary. So I think you have to love everything about all the roles in order to, you know, love the leadership role. And some people don't like leadership, but no, my answer is all of them. All of them were great. but yeah, if I had to choose between a director and head of product, probably head of product though.
Mm. Oh, interesting.
But I would take all of them though.
Well, you've been very lucky in that you've been able to do all of them.
I know. Yeah.
Omar, it's been so great talking to you, hearing your story and hearing all about the work that you're doing. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, it's absolutely my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
The Product Experience is the first
and the best
podcast from Mind the Product. Our hosts are me, Lily Smith.
And me, Randy Silver.
Lou Ron Pratt is our producer and Luke Smith is our editor.
Our theme music is from Hamburg-based band POW, that's P-A-U. Thanks to Arnie Kittler, who curates both Product Tank and MTP Engage in Hamburg, and who also plays bass in the band, for letting us use their music. You can connect with your local product community via Product Tank, regular free meetups in over 200 cities worldwide.
If there's not one near you, maybe you should think about starting one. To find out more, go to mindtheproduct.com/producttank.